I'm Olivia Frederick with the University of Louisville Oral History Center. Today, July 7th, 1979, I'm talking to Dr. C. Milton Young III at his office at 250 East Liberty in Louisville, Kentucky. Dr. Young was born in Louisville, Kentucky on November 13, 1930. He now resides at 739 Southwestern Parkway in Louisville. His parents were Dr. C. Milton Young Jr. and Hortense Houston Young.
Hortense
Houston Young. Would you like to answer that buzzer? Is that yours?
No, fine.
Dr. Young, would you first tell us just a little bit about your education and your medical training?
Well, I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, in the house of Dr. J.C. Lattimore, 15th and Walnut, which is now Muhammad Ali. I was educated in the city schools. I spent my initial 2 years in college at Howard University in Washington, D.C., subsequently transferred to the University of Louisville in 1950, I believe it was. In fact, I was, I believe, the first black undergraduate student at the University of Louisville. And my mother was the first graduate student at the University of Louisville. They had phased out the old municipal college at that time, and I entered in the summer session. Subsequent to that, I graduated from the University of Louisville with an AB degree in biology. Went to Fisk University for a brief period of time in graduate school, got drafted for the Korean War, spent 2 years in the Army, then went to Meharry Medical College in the School of Medical Laboratory Technology because I was too late to get into medical school when I got out of the Army. Spent 2 years in the School of Medical Technology, became a registered medical tech, and then subsequently entered School of Medicine at Meharry and graduated in 1961.
When did you first begin to professionally use the Red Cross Hospital?
During my time as a resident in internal medicine, I would do histories and physicals for some of the doctors at the Red Cross Hospital, and that was approximately 1962. I began my medical practice officially in 1965, and I would have a patient or two at Red Cross Hospital at that time.
I see. I know that your father is also a physician and practiced in the city. Do you have any memories of the hospital for this, you know, as a child or growing up in Louisville that you might recall? We have very few records, you know, on the hospital for that period.
Well, as a kid, I would remember riding out to the hospital. Of course, it was not in its present form.
In what way did it differ physically?
Well, there was a whole building that wasn't there. It was actually two buildings that had been sort of joined together. And I would go out and just sit down in a very small vestibule there and sit on the front steps or things while my father was inside working. And that would be my first remembrance of it. I was a patient there at one time. I guess it must have been 1936 or 37. To have my tonsils removed. And then, of course, back and forth just periodically. I truly don't remember when the new addition was built because I think...
1949 was the fundraising campaign. It was built, I think, in 50-51.
Well, see, then that's probably the reason because when I graduated from the University of Louisville undergraduate school, I left town for approximately I guess, 9 years away getting an education or being in the Army, etc.
Mm-hmm. As I understand it, the hospital was founded because blacks were unable to be treated by black physicians in the city's hospitals, other hospitals.
That's correct.
Is that true?
That's correct.
All right. You served on various staff committees at the hospital after you came to the city and started practicing. Can you tell us something about what sort of things you did, say, on the executive committee or the accreditation committee?
As far as the committees, actually there were not enough physicians there to have a lot of committees, and in a lot of instances we served as a committee of the whole. I truly can't remember exactly what committees. I'm sure that during the period of time I probably served on every committee one time or another.
Do you recall what sort of things the executive committee dealt with? What sort of problems, internal or?
Well, basically, being understaffed across the board, basically. We were having a problem with, getting new equipment, new beds, just revitalizing the whole situation. There's been a it was sort of a decline in the usage, obviously, when the other hospitals integrated. And basically the older doctors, the ones who'd been here all along, were the ones that used it mainly. There was a sort of a little cliquish situation going there too, when the new doctors would come in with, quote, newfangled ideas. Sometimes there was little abrasive encounters. We did manage, though, the newer doctors that did come in to update a lot of things, including the laboratories and things of that nature. So there was a little influx of new blood, so to speak. But basically, the hospital was still used by the older population, patient-wise, and by the older doctors.
It seems to me, from reading through many of these records, that you were instrumental in affecting some of these modern changes, particularly during your year as medical director, which was from about 1972 to 1973. What I'm going on is primarily as a report you submitted to the board with your resignation in June of 1973, in which you list the accomplishments for that period, and you talk about the laboratory, which had been modernized and that sort of thing. I was a little surprised in reading that report, though, to find things listed like, as accomplishments, such things as refurbishing of air conditioning, repainting of the second floor, which seemed to me to be more administrative than medical in nature. Why was this?
Well, the administrative procedures were very cumbersome. They were little fiefdoms, as it were, throughout the hospital. And I was approached to get involved, on a more consistent basis. And one of the prerequisites that I said was that if I have to go to all the committees, and it was almost like a one or a three-man show, so to speak, if I have to touch base with all committees and use the usual process up through administration to the board, mm-hmm. back down through administration, that, it would take years to do it. So it was a situation where I told them, I said, if we can form a three-man committee to effect changes for the betterment of the hospital, then I would accept the position.
I see.
But I would not have time for a lot of committee meetings because I was trying to maintain my own practice and everything else. And that through that particular ad hoc committee type approach that we could probably get a lot of things done, you know, in a very mm-hmm. short period of time, because things were very critical out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
critical.
So I told them that, you know, I would do it on that, you know, particular basis.
Who were the other people who served on this committee with you?
Mr. Waverly Johnson, who was the administrator, mm-hmm. and there was a board member on there. I truthfully don't remember at this particular time. I will remember shortly, but I don't remember right now. So, in using that particular approach, where the power of the board was basically invested in this three-man committee, that we didn't have to touch all of the bases.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that required an expenditure of money, naturally we consulted with the chairman of the board and Mr. William Summers, Reverend William Summers, to sort of expedite the matter.
In going through these records, I get the impression that the hospital did suffer from real administrative problems, and I really haven't been able to define what these were. Do you have any opinions on this? You sort of hinted at this in the statements now.
There was an old way of doing things and a new way of doing things. People have a tendency to be satisfied with something that's running well enough to suit them. At the time, we were in a survival mode, as it were. And of course, to turn that type of thing around, to get into a growth situation, you just had to do radical surgery. And the radical surgery was that the committee would come up with ideas, and if feasible, would approach approach the board with an idea. If the board accepted the idea, they would say, do it. And it cut down all of the, mm-hmm. you know, proposal writings and things of that nature.
Did the board at the Red Cross Hospital take a more active role in the internal operations of the hospital than most hospital boards do you think?
I think they did, basically, because, again, manpower-wise, we were just very, very short. There were four or five members of the board that, you know, truly were interested in getting mm-hmm. the thing off the ground. Very interesting how the hospital happened to fail. We failed because of success.
In what way?
Well, there were certain conditions that had to be met by some of the doctors who did not generally use the hospital. They had to have certain laboratory requirements and things that the hospital should have, mm-hmm. even a small hospital. And of course, they would not come. In fact, I would not go unless these changes were made. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times it was just a shoot from the hip situation. Well, make a long story short, the refurbishing of the second floor, painting, the air conditioning, the new beds, the, you know, the whole, even the relocation of the nursing station and things of that nature were done and were fairly well accepted by everybody. But when the increase in patients came, then it started showing the weakness of the system. The kitchen, who was very well able to take to prepare meals for 25 to 35 people, could not handle 57 people. The purchasing got thrown off. The new types of instruments and the new types of just adhesive tapes and things created a load on the central supply.
Mm-hmm.
We had to enlarge it, and it started to show that it could not handle the flow. admitting office could not handle things because of just the increased amount of paperwork. The business office was just inundated with the new insurance claims and forms and things of this nature. So, I mean, the whole system began to show cracks. We opened up floors that had been laying dormant. So then we had an immediate nursing problem. We had to acquire nurses. And, of course, the final event, as it were, was when we had the malpractice insurance went right through the roof. Not necessarily just for the Red Cross or Community Hospital, as it was called at mm-hmm. that time. Well, I think it went from some, now Mr. Johnson can probably give you the exact figures. It increased almost 500% overnight. You know, mm-hmm. you were paying $8,000 one night, and when the next premium came, you were up in the 30s, and the hospital just could not support that type of mm-hmm. of cost increase.
In a related manner to what you were just talking about, what do you think should or could have been done differently by the board of directors or the administrator to have prevented these problems or to have dealt with them? Do you think there was anything they could have done differently?
No. I think, again, it was a matter of little David around a lot of Goliaths. And I think their handwriting was basically on the wall for a small general hospital. We may have at one time turned into a different type of hospital, a nursing home or something of that nature.
There was but a I talk just, of this, wasn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, there was
quite
times. A bit of talk of converting into either some type of specialty hospital or a minimal care hospital where you would call in the army the walk-in wounded, people that did not require a lot of extensive surgery or things of that nature. There was a time when we had anticipated buying Parkway Medical Center, which is right next to the Medical Arts Building, and we went into that negotiation quite heavily because then we would have had a hospital, we would have just physically moved community mm-hmm. hospital or Red Cross Hospital to Parkway Medical Center, which would have given us a lot of advantages. Number one, of all of the doctors right next door. That's why now when you see a hospital being built or even some of the old hospitals, they're building up office complexes beside them to assure themselves that there would be an adequate supply of mm-hmm. physicians.
I believe there were negotiations also conducted at some point to acquire the old Norton's Hospital.
That is correct. We would have scaled it down and used more of the newer portions of it. We tried all sorts of things. Of course, then you come into a money situation. But I just think that we were probably just too small. Mm-hmm. I think that was the whole thing in a nutshell.
Getting back to that 1973 report to the board, you indicated there were several proposals which you wanted to see carried through, which you believe were vital to the institution. For instance, the community hospital or Red Cross Hospital affiliation with the Park Duval, is that how you say that neighborhood? Mm-hmm. Health center you described as having been hanging fire for 4 months. Was any sort of arrangement ever worked out between these two facilities?
No, no. There was a lot of rhetoric and a lot of meetings. I think basically that fell through on a personality problem more so than anything else. There were some members of the board and some members of the Park Duval board who, although on the surface, you know, appeared that it would, each institution would help the other mm-hmm. because we had beds where a lot of times individual could very short-term stays for very minor procedures. Would have helped both institutions, but there were several members involved in the negotiations that just sort of rubbed each other the wrong way, mm-hmm. and it postponed any agreement
another proposal, which you indicated might be financially lucrative for the hospital, was a pap smear contract from the State Department of Health. Do you know what happened there, why that never was carried through or barred?
We got caught in a political bind there. The State Department of Health had been farming these things out all around the state, and our pathologist at the time, who had the facilities to do all of these, plus we had a gynecologist who had done these type of preparations down at Vanderbilt, and we thought we could utilize, she was actually acting as a house officer at the time, and we could actually utilize her capabilities to provide an income to the hospital. Mm-hmm.
Another suggestion or proposal that you indicated you thought might be helpful was a metabolic clinic under the auspices of Dr. Perlstein?
Yes. He, Dr. Perlstein, needed at the time access to some beds. He is into, diabetics. He's into weight reduction and things of that nature. And the evaluations on these individuals did not require a super amount of sophisticated equipment, but it did require them to be on site, as it were. And of course, when he's competing for beds in the other hospitals, it just sort of disjointed the thing. Whereas if he could put them all in one place, then it would, it would facilitate his and plus add income to the hospital.
Mm-hmm. I take it that sort of arrangement was never worked out?
Well, we never really pursued it vigorously.
I see.
It was something that had been discussed between Dr. Perlstein and myself, and as a possibility. And I was just, again, laying things out as to some of the alternatives we might have had.
I see. Okay, fine. Earlier, you touched upon the effect of integration of health facilities in Louisville. I would like to ask you, to address yourself directly to that. In what ways do you think integration of the health facilities affected not only the community hospital, but the health care of blacks in Louisville in general?
Well, I think it improved it because for the first time, blacks had access to, black physicians had access to top grade technical expertise. One of the problems and one of the things I used to chide the older physicians out there is that their egos were not necessarily in good shape, because any time that they were isolated, I'll put it that way, and any contact that they had with white physicians was in a consultant type attitude, so to speak, which means that each time that they had any contact with one, they were calling one for some help. Of course, over a period of years, where you never meet anybody necessarily equal, because anytime you ran into them, they were coming to help you.
Right.
So it sort of damaged the ego, so to speak. And a lot of those doctors did not feel very comfortable in the Jewishes and the Nortons and all these other things, because on a one-on-one situation, they had all of this 30 or 40 years of deprivation.
Deferential behavior.
Yeah, right, and the whole bit. And it got in the way in a lot of instances.
Interesting. At one board of directors meeting, C. Whitney Young, in a very emotional discussion of the hospital's financial problems and the threatened closing, bemoaned the passing of black-run institutions. Did you share this sort of sentiment, believing that the black community suffered a loss in the passing of the hospital in any way?
I think it suffered an emotional loss. Not necessarily a medical loss, but an emotional loss, because community hospital, I believe, and this I'm sure can be checked, was the largest employer of blacks in the state of Kentucky, blacks employing blacks, which means that one of our, quote, major institutions went down the tubes.
What impact do you think the federal health programs, which started in the 1960s, had on the hospital?
Well, it had a positive and a negative effect. The positive effect was that there were large numbers of indigent individuals who could now afford medical care, which added to the bulk of individuals that you had to draw from, the pool. The negative effect is that the requirements to qualify for third-party payment through the government put a very, very heavy burden on a very small institution. You ever play those back to make sure you're recording?
Getting back to some of the internal problems the hospital had, it seems to me that during the latter years of the hospital's existence, that administrators had difficulty in obtaining competent support staff for the physicians. Do you think this is a correct assessment?
Very definitely.
Why do you think that was so?
Well, the salaries and the type of individuals that we actually needed. We needed actually stronger individuals than would probably be required for a larger institution, because this individual, nursing director and things of that nature, did not have the luxury of a large stair step type of thing where a lot of people were focusing in on a particular problem. It would come straight from the nursing station straight to the board of directors.
I see.
And not the nursing director.
Mm-hmm.
And there was not the siphoning process or the filtering process there. So when you're dealing in a one-on-one situation, the individual basically has to be very, very competent and very secure in their own knowledge. And these type of individuals can command a much larger salary than we could pay.
Was the keeping of records problem which existed at the community hospital, does that sort of problem exist at all hospitals, or was it, you know, particular or peculiar to Red Cross? I found many, many references to the chiefs of staff and medical director sending out memos to the physicians who used the hospital to keep their records that this was a problem in getting payment back from Medicaid and Medicare funds and this sort of thing.
That's a general problem.
I suspected as much.
Yeah. It was more crucial at Red Cross Hospital because we are drawing from a smaller pool. Just like a physician when he first starts out into practice, he's seeing five or six people a day. If four or five people do not pay him, it's a much more of a larger economic impact than if he's seeing 30 people a day and for four or five people don't pay him, then he can absorb that, he can wait. We did not have that luxury. And one of the problems that they had in the, even prior to my getting there, is that individuals would bring patients out and just really neglect doing the discharge summary and things of that nature, which third-party payers would like to have done before they'll give you any money. So if a person had 25 or 30 charts that needed dictating, it was a much greater impact on a 57-bed hospital than on a 450-bed hospital.
I suppose the federal health programs, Medicaid and Medicare, also increased the amount of record keeping that had to be done.
Definitely. The more I's dotted and T's crossed when dealing with Uncle Sugar, as they call him.
Can you tell me something about the utilization committees and how they worked that were set up to deal, as I gathered, to deal with the patients treated under Medicaid and Medicare programs? Are these They were staffed by physicians and administrators, weren't they?
Right. Well, all hospitals have these. It's a sort of a check on abuse. If a patient does not need to be in the hospital, or if I think the federal government has a rule that if a patient is there for 7 days, that the chart has to be reviewed to make sure that the patient truly needs to be there longer than that. And there are automatic review points, I think 7 days, maybe 14 days, mm-hmm. and then 21 days. And of course, we had to have committees to show that the chart was reviewed.
I was astonished at when I encountered this, that it just seems like a tremendous demand to be made of physicians to do this sort of thing, this very time-consuming process.
And if you don't have a large staff, you know, again, you find that one doctor will be on 3 and 4 committees, mm-hmm. and of course it just takes an inordinate amount of time, and was one of the things that kept a lot of the doctors from coming out there, because at Jewish Hospital, I'm presently on one committee. Occasionally I've been on 2 committees, but basically it's just a one committee deal. And an hour and a half or 2 hours once a month is much better mm-hmm. than, you know.
Certainly. There seemed to be a very close sort of working relationship between the Jewish hospital and community hospital. Is this true, that a lot of the physicians served on, or used both facilities? And if so, why was this, do you think?
Well, a lot of the doctors who served as consultants to the doctors at community mm-hmm. at Red Cross Hospital were on the staff at Jewish. And they had a long history of having come out there to do operations and do consultant work.
So it was just a long-standing, long-term relationship. What was the hospital's relationship with the Hammer Clinic?
The Hammer Clinic was negotiating, or wanted to negotiate, to use the facility for first trimester abortions. And negotiation really didn't come through to any great degree. There were some done there, but we could not and would not support the type of volume that they were anticipating. So it basically went by the wayside.
Well, you anticipated many of my questions, and we've gone discussed most of them. Is there anything that comes to your mind? Any problems or events associated with the hospital during your years of working there that you think would be helpful to people studying the hospital or Louisville or Blythe?
One of the things that just sort of observations that I would make at various periods of time is that, I don't know if you've come across it or not, but in the past, the Women's Auxiliary did a yeoman amount of work in raising monies and things, and holding teas mm-hmm. and providing volunteer type services and things. And I think that probably your picture will not be complete until you can delve into some of the things that they were doing, because they were much more important to Red Cross Hospital than the average auxiliary is to any other hospital. Much more important.
I had not gleaned that from the records yet.
Yeah.
Who would be someone associated with the Women's Auxiliary, do you think, that might tell us something about that?
I think you probably are going to have to talk to Mr. Waverly Johnson or Mrs. Dean. And I'm sure they can give you names of individuals who, over the years, you know, just rendered yeoman service.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's any recounting of the individuals that started the hospital. Do you have the big pictures of the, is it two sisters or two brothers?
two brothers, I think. We don't have any pictures then.
Yeah, well, there were some pictures in the hall, in the lobby there, of the individuals. There's another name I'll put out here, Stuart Pickett. I don't know if you've ever heard his name or not.
Yes.
But I believe his father was Dr. Pickett. Now, Stuart may know a lot of little background material that may have, I'm sure.
Matter of fact, they just conducted some interviews with him last month, or during June.
But no, I think his father was a physician here.
Okay.
And maybe through what Pickett saw, he may know some things that, you know, obviously I wouldn't have access to, because prior to 1963, you know, Red Cross Hospital was the building where my father went.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after that, you know, then I became involved myself. Little things like when I went out there and they approached me to being medical director, I think it was basically because, number one, I can be very outspoken, number one. Number two, I have a fairly large practice. And the theory was at the time, if I would start bringing some of my patients there, that the other doctors might drift back, plus the people that I use as consultants would start drifting back, and maybe, you know. But we were ill-placed to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
If this hospital had been, say, west of 20th Street, it would probably be still be in existence now. Just like I made them put me on a dollar a year salary, because I said you can't fire a volunteer. But if, you know, if you don't like what I'm doing, then of course this gives you the option of just saying, you know, your services are no longer needed.
There was talk of relocating even after the hospital closed its doors. Was anything ever done by anybody in an effort to reestablish another hospital after it closed?
I think that was basically just wishful thinking. To open up an institution in this day and time, or to move an institution, requires a tremendous amount of paperwork. And this is where we were the weakest.
Mm-hmm.
Proposal writing, grant writing, filling out the forms, you know, immediately when it became obvious that we were getting ready to close, then some of the health agencies around town here are going to be 73 beds thrown out on the open market. Who's going to get them? And all of these types of things. So there was a lot of backroom rhetoric about several institutions talked about absorbing the hospital, you know, because they would automatically get 70-some approved beds.
So there's competition for beds.
Oh, definitely. Just cutthroat competition. What we had proposed over at Parkway Medical Center were to have two floors of hospital and three floors of skilled care, so that the person could make a transition within the same building from an acute problem to a long-term convalescent problem and never leave the building, which would have been perfect, really.
Would there have been an outpatient clinic sort of operation also?
Yeah. We had an outpatient clinic, and we saw a lot of the people in the neighborhood, the staff doctors. See, prior to my going there, they had no staff doctor. They had one back in the 50s for a while. It was a young physician who, for room and board and nominal sum, you know, just stayed out at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a bachelor, so he had no real... So it sort of worked out that way, but that once he grew, so to speak, and actually had to move from there. I think when I came was the first time that we had physicians in the building at night, because one of the things that, you know, and I have to admire the physicians, the earlier physicians, because if anything happened at that hospital at night, you had to get up and go. You see, and this is one of the things, one of the luxuries that the modern hospital has. They have staff physicians in the building mm-hmm. at all times, so consequently you can get that half hour head start, as it were, on any, you know, critical problem that comes up. And not having an emergency room there, so we never had the luxury,
mm-hmm.
Even say at 5 o'clock or 3 o'clock, unless some doctor was just making late rounds, you know, by noon the place was devoid of doctors until mm-hmm. maybe 8 o'clock the next morning.
Yeah, well, this is an
intolerable situation, mm-hmm. particularly if you have a large number of people there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but. The systems, the cracks in the old walls, as it were, started showing when the volume did increase.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you pointed that out, I can see that in this material I've looked at already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were not equipped to handle, emotionally or physically equipped to handle, large numbers of people.
It does seem to me that there was a hardcore group of very dedicated people, both on the board and among the physicians in the community, and even the support staff. There was a hardcore, were very dedicated and made substantial sacrifices over the years to promote the welfare of the hospital and to try to save it.
Going to Red Cross Hospital was in itself a sacrifice. Most of us would not put a patient in danger. If a patient obviously required the services of a larger hospital, then naturally we would not take them to Red Cross Hospital. So I don't think that the patients did any suffering because they were fairly well filtered out there.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But to go out on Shelby Street, if the bulk of your practice is at Jewish Hospital, Norton's Hospital, and Methodist, to make that trip out to on Shelby was a trip,
mm-hmm.
if in the quote unquote. And again, I think there were a small group of dedicated doctors who wanted to preserve something that was strictly belonged to the black community. And there were other, like I say, whites who, you know, sweated equally side by side trying to,
mm-hmm.
you know, keep the facility going. What we probably needed more than anything else was a large donation, maybe in a couple of $1 million worth, to truly have an efficiently run small hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And you can parallel the problems that Community Hospital had with the problems that Western Jefferson Hospital out here has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a while for people to say that's my hospital, and consequently, so they have wards closed down out there, even though it's a brand new facility.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading about that
yeah.
in the paper.
Doctors have to get in the habit. Now, I can go to, I put 99, 44, 100% of my patients at Jewish Hospital. If I have a patient at Norton's, sometimes I'll find myself over here doing, you know, office work and say, I forgot to go to Norton's, you know, that type of thing. So it's, we're all creatures of habit.
Sure, sure. And there's just a certain number of hours in each day.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be allotted in the most effective way.
But people like Dr. Jesse Bell and Dr. Walls and my father, Dr. Rabb, you know, just put their life's blood into that hospital. But again, when they came along, that was all they had. And of course, you get familiar with what you do have. So consequently, it works out. I think in 1927, there were over 50-some black doctors here in Louisville.
That many? I'm
yeah.
surprised.
And there was almost a moratorium up until the 50s, late 50s, that we can't really say that a new black doctor came to town.
Why do you think that occurred?
Well, again, I think it was a cliquish situation, number one. Number two, almost all of them, without exception, were general practitioners. So they were competing for the same patient. And anytime anyone else would come in town, they just saw it as competition. So they
sort
would
of closed ranks, I
yeah,
suppose.
Yeah, closed ranks and painted some very bleak pictures of life in Louisville. And we have not overcome that. In fact, Dr. Maury Weiss, who's a cardiologist here, and I recently got together and we sent a letter to the president of the Jefferson County Medical Society, asking them to use their resources to identify, locate, and attract black doctors to this community. Because the Falls City Medical Society, which was the traditionally black society, we just don't have the resources to do the mailing and the, you know, the secretarial mm-hmm. things and things that you have to do to locate, get doctors to come and see and to tell them. Because right now, there are only two black internists in the state of Kentucky, myself and Dr. Ralph Morris. There's only one board surgeon, there's only one surgeon, black surgeon, mm-hmm. in the state of Kentucky. There are only three black doctors, what we call primary physicians, here at this particular point in time. You see.
And you think it's because of this negative image?
Well, negative image, and then I think basically right now it's because that there's no image at all out there. People just don't think of Louisville as a place to practice medicine. And we are probably more wide open than probably 80% of the other cities in the United States with an industrial base and everything else. Mm-hmm. So a physician in this town could probably very easily, you know, get established, and mm-hmm. you know, and all of the hospitals have open staffs, so you could pretty well go where you wish. But again, unless this message gets out to the medical schools mm-hmm. and the, you know, the places where black physicians are in training, mm-hmm. they just won't even think about it.
It's mm-hmm. interesting. To get back to the Red Cross Hospital for just a minute, you were talking about the hardcore dedicated group among the physicians. You named some of those. Who do you think among board members formed a part of this dedicated group?
Well, I think if you go back through the years, the names would change. Henry Habern was on the board for years and years and years. My mother, Hortense, was on the board for a few years during the critical stages of it. Certainly Reverend Summers, just did yeoman work as chairman and just general supporter.
Mm-hmm.
Laval Duncan, Whitney Young. I really better quit naming names because I know I'm going to forget. You know, if I were to see the rosters, mm-hmm. you know. But there were a small group.
I think the Tackhouse, some of the
yes, things. Yes, right, Reverend Tackhouse. And, of course, I only am familiar with the sort of the last group, as it were. John Clark from General Electric was on there, I think. Attorney Darrell Owens, but, you know, there's a lot of people put in a lot of time. And when we first opened up the new floor and everything else and had the lobby refurbished and the rugs down and the new laboratory, there was a general upsurge and, you know, mm-hmm. feeling of well-being. We had no way of knowing that with all these new facilities we were going to attract more patients, and that was what was going to kill us.
Ironic
mm-hmm.
and really very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Well, I thank you, Dr. Young. I think you have given us a lot of useful information.
Well, I hope so. People, I think, should know about institutions like that because, again, like it's just part of history.
I think so, too.
Do you have pictures of the institution?
We have some, but no, I guess mostly what we have are just newspaper pictures, things from, that were in the Courier or the Defender. I can't think of any other pictures, photographs we have. Do you know of the existence? You mentioned two that hung in the hallway.
Yeah, no, I was talking about just general pictures. Photography is one of my hobbies. And I took a lot of pictures out there, not necessarily of people, but just of the facility. I'll see that you get them. You
can just well, we can have them reproduced and return them to you.
Well, I have no, I have no particular use for them.
Oh, okay,
and,
certainly.
Give you the negatives also.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
But if any questions were to come up, but I think if you talk to Reverend Summers and Mr. John Waverly Johnson and Ms. Dean, they can probably give you names of 8 or 10 people who were out in the community that don't have a paper alliance with the hospital, but who had great effects on
it. Well, thank you. I'll try to get in contact with them.